Welcome to the Mint Euro Special 2016 podcast. Over the next 30 days, Ankit Prasad will take you through some of the most exciting happenings from on and off the football field.
The following is a conversation between Lionel Messi, Arsene Wenger and Robbie Keane about whether the European Championships are better than the World Cup. Lionel Messi: What do you mean are the European Championships better than the World Cup? In what way are they better? For one, the World Cup features the world's best players. Is the world's best player playing in France this summer? No, not Ronaldo. The world's best player is actually all the way across the Atlantic in USA at the Copa America Centenario. No, not Suarez either. He may have scored more goals, but who made them all? No, not Neymar. And Neymar isn't at the Copa either, by the way. The Brazilians are saving him up for the Olympics, as if they have a hope. But anyway, the Euros are nothing compared to the World Cup. There are fewer teams and most of them play a similar style. Besides, only two sides who won the European Championships went on to win the World Cup. West Germany won the Euros in 72 and the World Cup 2 years later, and Spain won in Europe in 2008 and 2012 and the World Cup in 2010. But then Spain was but a shadow of my team, Barcelona. So according to me, the European Championships aren't better than the World Cup or the Champions League. Robbie Keane: Oh no, Lionel. Club football isn't as exciting as international football. Maybe you prefer playing for Barcelona over Argentina because in Argentina they still think Maradona is the best player in history. And you know why they think that? Because Maradona single-handedly took Argentina to World Cup triumph in Mexico 86. I was a wee boy, but I still remember him knocking the stuffing out of England by first scoring the hand of God and then the goal of the century. Then they went into the final in front of over 100,000 people at the Estadio Azteca and took a 2-0 lead against West Germany. Then Germany scored two goals and equalized by the 80th minute, only for Jorge Bucaraga to score the winner. Maybe if your Argentina side had managed to do the same to Germany in the final 2 years ago, you'd be singing international football's praise right now. Arsene Wenger: I am surprised at you, Robbie. You still celebrate Maradona scoring with his hand against England to knock them out of the World Cup, but you forget that Zeando of Henry did the same to your country, the Republic of Ireland, in the World Cup playoffs in 2009, thus preventing you from qualifying for the tournament in South Africa. Still, we digress. I agree partially with Messi. The European Championships and the World Cup are merely a distraction without much meaning. It is the regular season and the club competitions that football is all about. By the end of the long European season, the players, they are so tired that they will have difficulty in finding the freshness to perform. And because they will overexert themselves being patriotic and while feeling honor to represent their countries, they may take it too far and get injured, and it could impact the club season. Jack Wilshere barely played for us this season, and still he's traveling to France with England. If he gets injured, I will have words with Roy Hodgson. And the same goes for Aaron Ramsey. Lionel Messi: Thank you, Mr. Wenger. If only you had displayed equal logic and purchased me all those years ago when you say you had the opportunity. To answer Robbie's question, winning that World Cup is much harder than it seems. Germany were very powerful and had beaten Brazil 7-1 in the semi-final and were hence high on confidence. Also, most of their best players, Müller, Kroos, Schweinsteiger, Lahm, and the goalscorer Götze, played for Bayern Munich. Because of that, they were able to perform much better as a team. My Argentina side was full of stars from different teams. I play in Barcelona, Angel Di Maria in Real Madrid, Gonzalo Higuain was in Napoli, and Kun Agüero wasn't fit. Becomes difficult to win, no? Arsene Wenger: You can still join us, Lionel. How do you feel about playing alongside Jamie Vardy and Olivier Giroud instead of Iniesta next year? No? Okay, I'll pretend I didn't hear that. Anyway, Robbie, I just thought I would add to the point. The best players all play in the European club competitions, no? This season, despite the Euros being expanded to accommodate 24 teams instead of 16, the Netherlands have missed out. Ronaldo and Pepe had to be given holidays so that they could rest after their Champions League final. What we are going to get is a competition full of tired players, and without the third place team from the previous World Cup and the runner-up from the one before that.
Robbie Keane.
Ah, come off it. European club competitions take place every year and all they do is divide people. Arsenal fans are busy hating Tottenham, managers are playing merry-go-rounds, and for fans of most of the small teams, there's never a silver lining to that cloud, is there? And don't say Leicester, that's yet to sink in. Even the World Cup has always been won by the big sides. The closest anyone came to an upset was those pesky South Koreans in 2002, and I remember the partisan refereeing then when they knocked us and the Italians out. On the other hand, the Euros have a history of upsets and giant killing runs. Denmark won against all odds in 1992. They didn't even have their best player playing, Michael Laudrup, but they still won. And Greece, they're still pinching themselves after winning in 2004. They had almost no attacking verve and yet they managed to eliminate Zidane in France and also defeat the host Portugal twice. It's the last thing they remember before their economy went up in flames, I tell ya. Think of all those close European rivalries from centuries worth of history. Just the return of the British nations makes it worth it. England, Wales, Northern Ireland, and the Republic of Ireland. And the Scots can tuck into haggis at home. That's why the Euros are better than the World Cup and even club football. Anyway, I've gotta go now. Best of luck for whatever you lot are gonna be doing this summer. I'll send you a postcard from Paris. Hello and welcome to European Nights, a podcast about football. I am Ankit Prasad. Today is Wednesday the 8th of June 2016, which means that we are less than 3 days away from kickoff at the Stade de France. Yes, the European Championships are once again upon us. That's a really good thing about the sport, you know. Only every alternate summer is a long summer without football. Now the Euros are bigger than ever this year. The previous two editions had been dual-hosted by first Switzerland and Austria in 2008 and then Poland and the Ukraine in 2012. But this time around, we return to a European superpower, one that has always fared well as the home side. We will get back to what lies in store in France this year, but first let us lay a bit of groundwork. European football and the European Championships are seeped in history. It is the stage at which some of the greatest players have left their mark and their exploits have become legend. International football, despite being so huge now, has far humbler origins than club football. It seems like for various reasons such as traditions, geopolitics, and often just geography, it was difficult to set up a big tournament, even quadrennially. For a very long time, some nations such as England couldn't be bothered. They thought that they had invented football, which they may have, but much like Amir Khan and his team of villagers in Lagan, they underestimated how powerful and popular the sport would become and how easily these people from far-flung lands way across the seas would take to it and give it their own style and quickly master it. By the time the first European Championships were played in 1960, we had already seen 6 World Cups. Europe and South America were neck and neck. Uruguay appeared to be early masters and alongside Italy had won 2 of the first 4 tournaments. In the final of the World Cup of 1950, when the tournament was being held in Brazil, Uruguay faced the home team in the final before almost 200,000 people at the Maracanã. The partisan home crowd had thought that victory was at hand when Brazil were leading till the 66th minute, but in the next 15, Uruguay scored 2 goals and ended up winning their second World Cup. In the process, shocking and depressing all of Brazil. The match came to be known as the Maracanazo and is remembered as a Brazilian tragedy that sent an entire nation into mourning. Just 4 years later, the competition moved back to Europe and in the picturesque surroundings of Switzerland, Hungary were considered a shoo-in to win. The mighty Magyars played football in a way that it had never been played before. The only thing standing between them and immortality were West Germany, just a decade or so after the Second World War. Hungary had beaten West Germany already in the tournament 8-3, but in the final, Germany managed to pull one out of the bag and beat Ferenc Puskas and team by 3-2 in a match that came to be known as the Miracle of Bern. It wouldn't be the last time that a German side defeated the overwhelming favourites to triumph at a major tournament either. A close examination of the European Championships once they had begun in 1960 reveals that at first it was a far smaller competition. The first five editions had just four teams contesting the final tournament. The next four had eight teams. The Soviet Union, now defunct, was very successful in the early days. They won the championships in 1960 and were runners-up on three separate occasions in the next seven tournaments. In the last of these, in 1988, they met the Netherlands in the final in Munich. The Dutch had one of the strongest, most attacking and complete football teams and philosophies in the 70s, but had fallen short whilst taking the final step. At these championships, a new generation of talented individuals had taken the place of Cruyff, Niskins and the others. Marco van Basten would go on to score the winner in that match against the Soviet Union, and if a goal were measured as a product of aesthetics and importance, van Basten's controlled volley from a tight angle that flew over the keeper and into the goal, thus winning his side their first and up until now only major tournament, will go down as one of the greatest ever scored in the sport's history. These big tournaments have frequently led to major revolutions in the way football is played, often disproportionately, considering that a far greater majority of football is played in the annual club competitions. The current double European champion, Spain, showed us a way of playing football that few teams or none had an answer for. The Spaniards' retention of the ball, which is also associated with the dominance of Barcelona Football Club, has seen Spain becoming the center point of football and the world capital of trophies. With one World Cup, two European Championships and three Champions Leagues, it's easy to forget that the foundations of tiki-taka football were laid at Euro 2008. Between the seed of Brazil's tryst with the World Cup being planted with that traumatic loss in 1950, Germany's rise and Hungary's fall just 10 years or so after a cataclysmic world event, Marco van Basten scoring a goal that enabled his tiny country to defeat a vast and evil empire, and Spain taking technical football to another level, the major tournaments have all too often ended up becoming inflection points both within the sport and beyond. This next month in Europe has vast potential for doing the same. More than European football, which has proved to be highly resilient, Europe as a continent is at a crossroads. Events in the past couple of years, in particular to do with the economy and more recently with the immigrant influx and the war on ISIS, has given the continent plenty of difficult decisions to make. For instance, the referendum on Britain exiting the European Union, or Brexit, is scheduled just 2 weeks into Euro 2016. If England, who have now gone 50 years since winning a major tournament, what they like to call 50 years of hurt, manage to put on a good show, and if the other home nations, Northern Ireland, the Republic of Ireland and Wales, also manage to give their people something to cheer, could it end up impacting the future of the European Union? And what of the hosts? They have struggled to find their feet after Zinedine Zidane's retirement now a decade ago. Will a talented and multi-ethnic French side once again be able to rise to the top of the world, or at least the continent this time around? And what about reigning world champions Germany, the last tournament's runners-up Italy, or any of the other 24 nations that are arriving in France for the biggest European championships ever? How significant could Euro 2016 end up being? We are about to find out. We'll take a walk down memory lane now, to the last time that the Euros were held in France. The 80s, in hindsight, seemed to be the decade of great individual performances in international tournaments. The idea of one person dragging their team to the very summit of the sport is romantic, but rare. Diego Maradona did it in the 86 World Cup, but just 2 years earlier, in 1984, Michel Platini was the best player in the world. We may know him better now as an administrator, a suit, and depending on whom you believe, a corrupt ex-pro who bought his sport into disrepute. But back then, he was a wiry and tall midfielder who could, as per one account, thread the ball through the eye of a needle and finish. Now, to be fair, it would be unfair to make it sound like Platini was the only quality player for Le Bleu. He played as part of a midfield that was called La Caire Magique, or Magic Square, that also comprised of Louis Fernandez, Alain Giresse and Jean Tigana. They didn't quite hold the ball like Xavi and Iniesta and Kodu, but just like their skipper, they had plenty of explosive attacking intent. In the first match, they came up against Denmark, and it was Platini who scored the only goal of the game. A scrappy pass into the net from outside the box in the 78th minute. Belgium were up next at Nantes, and the French magic square greedily ate up the Red Devils. Platini scored a hat-trick, the perfect hat-trick. Left foot, right foot, header. And Gires and Fernandez got one each. In the final group game, Yugoslavia took the lead. But in 18 crazy minutes of the second half, Platini first brought France level with his left foot, then scored a majestic diving header from the penalty spot, and finally put the game to bed with an impudent free kick where he hardly took a run-up. Yugoslavia got one back at the end, but lost 3-2. As there were only 8 teams involved, the semi-finals and Portugal were up next. Semi-finals are often the best matches in any sporting tournament, as the best teams are able to concentrate on the performance without fear of losing at the grandest stage. France-Portugal completely lived up to the hype. At the Stade Vélodrome in Marseille, the two sides played out a 1-1 draw at full time. France had taken the lead through a defender, Jean-François Domergue, who scored a pile driver of a free kick in the 24th minute. They continued to dominate the chances but failed to convert, and late in the second half, the Portuguese equalised through Jordão, who bagged a free header. The match went into extra time, and that's when calamity struck. Jordão clearly had the measure of the French defenders and scored a bouncing volley to give his side the lead. With the clock winding down, France became desperate, and in that desperation, they piled forward. One move resulted in a bit of pinball in the box, and at the end of it, Domergue found the goal at his mercy and scored his and his team's second of the night. Then, with just minutes to go and penalties beckoning, Jean Tigana burst through the right channel and crossed the ball for Platini to control and smash in to secure a thrilling victory and break Portuguese hearts. France had reached the final, where they would meet Portugal's fellow Iberian neighbours Spain, led by Carlos Santillana, José Antonio Camacho and José Carrasco, heavyweights of Real Madrid and Barcelona. It was the keeper, however, Luis Arconada, who would play the most crucial part. In the 57th minute, Platini took a free kick from just outside the box that curled towards a waiting Arconada at the far post, but instead of fielding it, he let it slip through his grasp, then dived helplessly after it as it rolled over the line. France were a goal up at the Parc des Princes. Spain then chased the game, and France even had a player sent off, but they held firm, and in the final minute, the striker, Bruno Bellon, was put through on goal and delicately lobbed the keeper to spark wild celebrations both in the stadium and across the country. It was the only goal a striker scored for France in the entire championships. Michel Platini, who had scored an astounding 9 goals in the tournament, would go on to lift the amphoric trophy. His performances, not limited to this tournament, would inspire millions, including Zidane, and he is still regarded, despite the highs and lows, as one of the greatest midfielders to have ever played the game. A lot will happen this summer. Old heroes and moments will be remembered, and new legends will be born. A thrilling month awaits us, and we'll be following every match, every goal, and even every goalless draw, because sometimes there's nothing better than a nice goalless draw. Stay tuned for many, many more European Nights.